Hello everyone and welcome back to the History of England at a Gallop. 1643 to 1646, the First Civil War, which covers the period from January 1643 to June 1646, which was dealt with in 13 episodes, unlucky for some, between 387 and 399. The purpose of the At a Gallop episodes is to give you a rather more summarised coverage of the period, should you have, I don't know, got a bit lost in all the detail and names. Or, if you just want to go through the history of England at a faster pace, you've got other things to get on with. So, just a reminder, you do not need to listen to this episode at all. You can simply stick to the numbered, detailed episodes, if that's going fine for you. But, if you want that refresher, or that faster gallop, then this is for you. In the last At a Gallop episode, we heard about how the Three Kingdoms abandoned the search for peace and came to blows. A phony war almost after the execution of Strafford in May 1641, where both parties talked peace, but prepared for war, and laid out to the great British public their views of the issues over which the war would be fought. Their own interpretation of the ancient constitution of England, basically, and the form of religion. Until, in August 1642, Charles said hang it all and raised the royal standard at Nottingham. Enough talking. And we then got all fighty. The first major encounter at Edge Hill, the King's March on London, and the sabre-rattling at Turnham Green, where the Oyster Women of London did indeed Turnham Green, and Charles retreated to his HQ at Oxford, and everyone got ready for next year's campaign. That was where we left it. Now then, in this episode then, we will gallop through the guts of the First Civil War in under an hour. You are aware that there were not only three kingdoms, but three civil wars, were you not? If not, now you are. This is merely the first one. Though I have to say, it is the biggest one, to be fair. So we're going to talk about 3 years, as I say, 1643 to 1645, by the end of which one of these two sides will be on their last legs, militarily speaking. You'll have to wait to find out which, though. Tense! On the way, we will also find out why Philip Skippon is just like old Mother Hubbard. Let's start off by talking about the shape of this war, shall we, and the participants within it. Which is one advantage of doing an overview, I have to say. This first stuff I'm going to talk about is in episodes 391 and 392. In those, I talk about the military, the experience of soldiering, and the experience of the ordinary Joe of the Civil War, Joe with and without an E. The King is in his counting house then, counting out his money. The Queen was in her parlour eating bread and honey, or rather, the King was in Christ Church College, Oxford, worrying about money, and the Queen will be in Merton College, Oxford, telling her husband to get on with it and whip those damned rebels good. Basically, what I'm saying is that Oxford was set up like the royal court in Westminster when the royalty had been still there. Parliament were, of course, where they'd always been in London, which has got to be the biggest single advantage of the whole shooting match. Oh, that and the fact that God was on their side. Apparently. Although, Charles thought God was on his side as well. Well, we'll just have to see which way God's providence falls. By and large, the King's strength is in the southwest, the west, Wales, and north. Parliament is strong in the rest, but especially East Anglia. But, and I say again, but, this is a regional war. It reaches its tentacles and discord and violence down into every locality, into every town, into every village. So, when I say the West is royalist, well, you've already heard that around Hereford, Brilliana Harley held Brampton Bryant for Parliament, while in East Anglia, King's Lynn was living up to its name. In some areas, loyalties often lasted only so long as the last marching army was around, keeping them loyal. Even the marching armies themselves are regional. There are multiple commanders and multiple regional armies. Holding territory, though, was important because territory meant the sinews of war. Territory meant tax. both sides established their methods of tax collecting. Royalists tended to use the existing structure of Lords Lieutenant and JPs, whereas Parliament was forced to innovate. Each county then had a county committee for Parliament. Now, if you are looking for areas of agreement in these divided times, here is one. If you say, everyone hated the county committees, every historian will take a breather from hitting each other over the head with their pet theories in the pub brawl that is academia, turn to you and nod furiously. Everyone hated the county committees because they raised taxes. Everyone was taxed by both sides, though far more than ship money ever promised. They sequestered opponents' estates, and crucially, the county committees, unlike the Lords Lieutenant and the JPs, offended the natural order of things, because they were often peopled by the middling sort. Now, this outraged some. They believed that exploiting the masses was the job of the nobility. After all, they were good at it, and they'd been doing it for so long. Who are these oiks to exploit us with taxation now? So, everyone, in order to maintain territory, they set up garrisons to police, hold and tax each locality. Often, opposing garrisons faced each other and fought over said territory, creating a nation of frontier country and nation of borders. And meanwhile, there were local armies all over the place. So, here are some stats which help paint that picture. In most histories, we tend to focus on about five or six of the major battles, like, you know, Edgehill, Marston Moor, that sort of thing. But in fact, there are 645 military actions. Do not worry, I make no effort at all, even the detailed episodes, to cover all of these. Though, you know, if you're in the market, just let me know. Anyway, it's a lot, is what I'm saying. Of those 645 military actions, 198 were sieges. I mean, blimey, O'Reilly. So 21,000 people lost their lives directly in sieges. So my message is, this is not a war between two neatly delineated camps in two parts of England and Wales. This is everywhere, coming to a village near you very soon, which is why quite so many people die. You might wonder about the level of commitment of the ordinary Joe and Joes to war. And that is a constant debate. Was this really about the common people or not? What's clear is that there are a range of opinions in even the most staunch of paces. So let us take London, for example. Throughout 1643, there was a constant stream of royalist individuals leaving London and making their way to the King's Court at Oxford. And yet, there are still plenty left there for the king and queen to confidently plot rebellion in the big smoke. And furthermore, in 1643, there was a massive women's peace petition, streaming in their thousands through London, demanding peace, wearing white ribbons, and peacefully demanding the head of John Pym on a plate, just like Salome. The plague on both your houses sentiment is as strong as the partisan emotion, as we will learn from the Clubmen of 1645. So while we're on all of that, in terms of the total numbers, it's reckoned that in England and Wales, 190,000 people died, which is 3.7% of the population. That is a lot, a higher percentage than the First World War, for example. In Scotland, 60,000 die, and that's actually 6% of her much smaller population. Ireland, of course, is the hardest, because the records are rubbish there. And so the subject is ripe for hyperbole, but there is no doubt that it's worse there by some distance. So Charles Carleton, he goes for 618,000 dead. That is a massive 41% of Ireland's 1.5 million population. On the other hand, the Irish historian Porrig Lenehan comes in at the lowest estimate with a still hideous 300,000. 20% of the population. So that's probably your range, between 300,000 and 600,000 dead in Ireland. Now, maybe this was a different order of magnitude to the 30 Years' War with its 5 million dead, but bowl of cherries or gentlemanly engagement before tiffin, it was neither. Overall, the death rate may have been as high as 11% of the British population of the Three Kingdoms. To give you a bit of scale of the military, at any one time during the wars, there were probably about 150,000 men under arms, including garrisons, mind. The size of British armies would have made the 30 Years' War general snort with derision. I think we reach a maximum total battle size of 40,000, and that was the standard size for just one mid-sized army in the 30 Years' War. But still, it's big enough. Two things then about the marching armies. In Ian Gentle's famous phrase, they are like mushrooms. They spring up overnight with the manure of a recruiting campaign, then have disappeared metaphorically in the morning after a battle, when they feel they've done their bit for the cause and can go now, or when the militias decide they really need to go back to their farms or their businesses and see to stuff. One reason for the latter, actually, was a long-held tradition of the county militias and trained bands, which was that their job was to defend their county, so no soldier thought they should be required to fight outside their county until the new model army comes and changes that old model. And if they were made to do so, then individuals were just as likely to desert as they were to, I don't know, breathe. I was going to say something here about the formal armies and their composition, their components, about artillery, cavalry, infantry, and, usually ignored, the navies. But look, I just don't have space. So, to get the lowdown on the military, hie thee to episodes 391 and 392. As 1643 started then, Charles probably had his nose in front, and people worried that he was now planning a great pincer movement, armies from north, midlands and southwest, converging on poor old London. Now, Charles had a habit of consulting far more than he needed to or ought to have done, and was an overly deferential commander, actually, especially towards his best commander, his famously dashing, floppy-haired, talented and thuggish nephew, Prince Rupert. So that winter in 1643, he will have consulted with his Privy Council and his Council of War. Charles will have many factions around him to control, but let us divide them broadly into two, with all the provisos, that all of them have different shades of opinion about individual situations and all of that, and that labelling is disabling. This is something I learned from a parenting book, actually, that I used to read while snarling, "Shut the devil up, Daddy's reading," at the little ones, which is deeply ironic. But anyway, so on the one hand, you have the constitutional royalists like Edward Hyde. They wanted to find peace at a reasonable price so that they could live with each other afterwards. They had supported initial constraints on the king before feeling that Parliament had gone too far. And Hyde was very influential on both councils. On the other end of the spectrum, then, there are the swordsmen, principally Rupert, but actually principally almost also very much Henrietta Maria. Crush them. Become the absolute ruler you were always meant to be. Oh, and actually there is a third faction. George Digby, who's an idiot. Anyway, the big coordinated pincer movement didn't happen. Instead, there are a series of regional wars. In the north, Charles has a fabulously rich general, William Cavendish, the Earl of Newcastle, who would spend £1 million on the royal cause, including kitting out his famous white coats. So that's £120 million of his personal money in today's values. No wonder the king had a head start with folks like that. He had a similarly well-heeled supporter in Wales as well. Cavendish was very erudite, cultured, passionate and loyal, very likeable actually. Probably not the top draw of military commander. This is no Subadai, much given to staying in bed till 11 o'clock and then spending hours on his toilet, for example. But he has his moments, actually. And 1643 turned out to be one of those moments. Against his relatively massive army of 10,000 was broadly arranged the grand family of the Hothams in Hull and the lesser gentry, the Fairfaxes, Father Fernandino and his son, the famous one, Thomas Fairfax. The Hothams did not like the Fairfaxes. As far as they were concerned, they were little better than oiks, and they should be under the command of the Hothams rather than the other way round. it may be partly the influence of these social factors which tempted the Hothams into treachery. But before they could turn Hull over to the king, they were caught, jailed, and in 1645 had their heads cut off. This left the Fairfaxes in Yorkshire, and for much of 1643, Thomas was making a fair fist of this. He was helped in this by a sort of clubman, a very partisan type of clubman, in the clothing towns of the West Riding of Yorkshire. They rejected their gentry, who were royalists to a man, and declared for Parliament. Sadly, it was not to be. On the 30th of June at Adwalton Moor, Newcastle took on Fairfax, and Newcastle gave Fairfax a thrashing. You can hear about that in episode 388, and also about Thomas's flight with the wife he adored, Anne de Vere, riding shotgun behind him on his horse. Well, that was that. The North belonged to Charles, and all that remained of Parliament's hopes were stuck behind the walls of Hull, with Newcastle sitting impatiently with his army outside, waiting for them to starve. The second major arena of 1643 was in the southwest, where the opposing generals were two bosom pals, the royalist Ralph Hopton and the parliamentarian William Waller. They'd fought together in Europe. They tried very hard not to fight at all. Ralph suggests that they should meet up and try and sort something out between them. In return, he received a letter that gives expression to the tragedy of a civil war. I didn't really have the space for this, but what the hell. This is a letter from William to his friend Ralph. "The experience I have of your worth and the happiness I have enjoyed in your friendship are wounding considerations when I look at this present distance between us. Certainly my affection to you is so unchangeable that hostility itself cannot violate my friendship. But I must be true wherein the cause I serve. That great God, which is the searcher of my heart, knows with what a sad sense I go about this service, and with what a perfect hatred I detest this war without an enemy. But I look upon it as the Lord's work, and that is enough to silence all passion in me. The God of peace, in his good time, will send us peace. In the meantime, we are upon the stage and must act those parts that are assigned to us in this tragedy. Let us do so in a way of honour and without personal animosities. Whatever the outcome, I will never willingly relinquish the title of your most affectionate friend." In the end, Ralph and William will meet a couple of times in battle. To and fro it goes, until they meet on the famously hilly countryside outside Bath, Roundway Down. And there it is Hopton who triumphs, Waller's army is smashed, and he runs all the way back to London. Now, Waller up to this point had won every engagement he'd been involved in, so much so that he'd been called William the Conqueror by the parliamentary news sheets. Now the royalist news sheets get their own back and mockingly call this battle Runaway Down. So, that's two out of two. Adwalton Moor, Roundway Down, the king is well in the lead now. Oh, and by the way, you must go to episode 389 and find out about news sheets generally. Essentially, England discovers scurrilous journalism started at Mercurius Aulicus, created in Oxford by John Birkenhead. They would soon be joined by others in London, including the most famous journalist of them all, Marchmont Needham, whose name, he said, rhymed with freedom. So look, London's in a pother. Surely now the king would gather his skirts around him, or his armies at the very least, and advance on the big smoke and snuff out the fires of rebellion. All that stood between him and victory was the supreme parliamentary general, the Earl of Essex. Things looked even worse when in June 1643 the revolution lost one of its great heroes, John Hampden, the great patriot, killed at the Battle of Chalgrove. And indeed, Charles did indeed start to advance on London. Then he and Rupert had a bit of a chat. The parliamentarian garrison at Gloucester stood between them and London. Should they take it to remove a potential pain in their behind, or should they just ignore it and strike for the big London prize? Rupert said, "Look, let's do this right. Let's take it. It'll only take a day or two." But he was wrong. Gloucester was much tougher than it looked. So they sat there and they sat there, they stuck, nor breath nor motion, and it gave time for Essex to get his act together, and he finally turned up in August with the London-trained bands and their tough military commander Philip Skippon, and he lifted the siege. Well, Charles was not finished yet. Essex might think he could get back to London, job done, but not on your Nelly, or indeed anybody else's Nelly, come to think of it. With some clever feints, skips and hops, Charles skipped round Essex, so that when Essex came across the River Kennet at Newbury, he found a ruddy great big army in the way. He would have to fight his way through to get back home. Now, Essex has generally been seen as a bit of a pudding as a commander. But at Newbury, he took the initiative, marching early doors to get the best position on high ground facing the Royalist army right from under their noses, and so this job looked a bit more difficult. The stakes at the following Battle of Newbury were very high. It's unlikely the Parliamentarians could have survived all three of their armies being wiped out in the same year. Newbury was a hard-fought fight, which you can hear about in episode 389. It was fought in difficult, hedge-covered country. Philip Skippon's London-trained bands proved tough, and at the end of the day, they'd earned a score draw. Disaster for Parliament had been averted. Though not for one of Charles's advisers, it has to be said, just to briefly pause to tell you a story. The emotional Viscount Falkland. This war without an enemy sickened him too, and that morning of the battle he was heard to say that he was weary of the times and foresaw much misery to his country and did believe he should be out of it ere night. He charged the battle in a deliberate attempt to seek out death, and death duly found him. Two more things before we say farewell to 1643. As 1643 started, both King and Parliament were looking for friends to help them fight the good fight, and the available sources of added might were the Irish Confederate Association and the Covenanting Scots. To be fair, Parliament would never have considered the Irish Confederates, and to be fair, Charles never really had a chance with the Scots, since he had given them so many examples since 1638 of his double-dealing and untrustworthiness. And he treated their commissioners in 1643 when they came to Oxford with haughty disdain, and then was found cooking up a plot with the Earl of Antrim and the Earl of Montrose to invade the Scottish Highlands even while they were talking about peace. So that was the end of Charles as far as the Covenanters were concerned. The result was a deal negotiated in Edinburgh between Harry Vane of the English Parliament and the Covenanters. It was called the Solemn League and Covenant. You can find out more about this critical thing in episode 390. But look, under its terms, Scotland would get pretty much all it wanted. Scotland was looking for security against the king they just did not trust at all and who they believed would renege on any deal as soon as possible and use the power of England to do so. So, the deal they made with him in 1641 must be made irreversible. To achieve that, England and Scotland must be aligned in religion under the Scottish Presbyterian model. They would have a seat in the body set up in England to review religion then, the Westminster Assembly of Divines. Plus, the Scots would also have space on the governing body of the English kingdom, now to be called the Committee of Both Kingdoms. In return for all of this, they would provide an army of 21,000 men. Meanwhile, Charles had made a deal of his own with the Confederate Association of Ireland. The cessation, as it was called, allowed for an extended truce while a full treaty was agreed. Under its terms, Charles would be able to take an Irish army back to England. Look, both of these deals had major consequences. The cessation was a PR disaster for many English. Here was their king dealing with the Catholics who had caused such slaughter of Protestants in 1641 in Ulster. In point of fact, most of the troops that came to England, about 9,000 of them, would be English rather than Irish. The Solemn League and Covenant was even more momentous than that, though. It was blindly imposed by the Scots at a time of dire English need, so they had to accept it. Even Harry Vane, who negotiated it, hated its necessity. Vane was one of those many in England now who believed not in one national Presbyterian church, but that everyone should find their own way to God, a group known as the Independents. The Solemn Lead never had a chance of succeeding without massive religious oppression. It would remain a constant source of fiction, both between the English and the Scots, and between the English Presbyterians who supported it and those that believed in toleration, the Independents, not to mention the Anglicans. Last 1643 thing, the death of the architect of the revolution, John Pym, who died in December. Thus was Parliament shorn of its two best leaders, John Hampden and John Pym. Leadership would pass instead to the likes of Oliver St John, Lord Sayenseal, Harry Vane, and the Committee of Both Kingdoms. Now 1644 dawned full of hope for Charles after a pretty good 1643 that had delivered two cracking victories and a close-run thing. He had lots of his most dedicated supporters to share the moment with him too, because Edward Hyde had persuaded him to call a parliament in Oxford. Potentially this was a great idea, an attempt to establish an alternative, legitimate parliament rather than that rebel one without a king in Westminster, and bolster Charles's claim to be at the head of the real ancient constitution. The Oxford Parliament has been described as his most successful. It voted him money, and there was not one fallout. But the mood would cool over the year, and by the start of 1645, Charles would be calling it contemptuously his mongrel Parliament. The blessed people kept asking him to make peace with the rebels. Well, he wasn't having that, so he dissolved it. After all, that had worked pretty well in the past, and never change a winning formula. Charles's optimism, though, was misplaced, and it was always going to be. 1644 was always going to be tough for him. The main reason for this was the Scots. Following the agreement of the Solemn League at the start of January 1644, they streamed over the borders towards Newcastle. Suddenly, Cavendish was forced to raise the siege of Hull, go north to try and hold them back. He faced a tall order, his 10,000 men against twice that number. However nice their little white coats were. Actually, again, for a few months he made a pretty good fist of it, despite facing a thoroughly high-class general in Alexander Leslie, a field marshal of the Thirty Years' War under Gustavus Adolphus. Newcastle and his white coats marched and countermarched, while the city of Newcastle held out against the Scots with grim determination. The Scottish commissioners in London watched all this and they were embarrassed. They thought their army, winner of the Bishop's Wars, and doing God's work, of course, would surely polish off the King's forces in a matter of weeks. Robert Bailey wrote from London, "We are exceeding sad and ashamed that our army, so much talked of, has done nothing as yet at all. What can be the reason of this we cannot guess, only we think that God, to humble our pride, has not yet been pleased to assist them." Meanwhile, before he died, John Pym had bequeathed one more gift to the Parliament he had served so well, a new army. Working day and night, he had manoeuvred and cajoled Parliament into establishing a massive new army from East Anglia under the Earl of Manchester, with his second-in-command, the cavalry commander, rising star and darling of the news sheets, Colonel Oliver Cromwell, now made Lieutenant General of Horse. Already Cromwell had won himself a scalp, defeating a detachment of Newcastle's army at Winsby, and the unusual discipline of his men and his cavalry was to earn them the name of the Ironsides, given with reluctant admiration by his cavalry opponent, Prince Rupert. Now in May 1644, Scottish numbers began to tell, and they began to force Newcastle back towards York. Manchester's Eastern Association Army also now threatened the critical Royalist fortress of Newark in the Midlands. Newark connected Royalist Midlands to Royalist North, so its loss would be a terrible blow. Meanwhile, down south, Ralph Hopton invaded Hampshire, hoping to repeat the success of Roundway Down, but this time it was Waller who came out on top at the Battle of Cheriton. Waller then made his way north to the Oxford area as ordered, to hook up with Essex, and their joint army would then crush the king, besiege Oxford, end the war so that everyone could live happily ever after. It is a great plan. And in the Midlands, at least they now outnumbered Charles. Now, 1644 would be a good year for Charles personally as a warrior. He plays a very nice campaign at this point. He led Essex and Waller a dance all over the Cotswolds west of Oxford. They just couldn't get hold of the slippery king. And at the same time, Essex and Waller happened to, well, you know, hate each other. It does happen from time to time. So Essex decided that rather than stick around with Waller chasing that damned elusive king and Earl, he should really head to the south coast and rescue the fair town of Lyme Regis, because it's being besieged by Prince Maurice. Everyone said, don't talk daft, but he went anyway. Which is when Charles turned around and defeated Waller on the 29th of June, 1644, at Cropredy Bridge. So it's really all fallen to pieces for Parliament in the Midlands. Waller was sitting with half an army in Abingdon and seriously beginning to feel he wasn't cut out for generalling. This means you and I can now turn our attention back to the north. Now look, Prince Rupert has this mammoth reputation as a military god, and 1644, for most of it, was a very good example of what made him so formidable. In March 1644, the commander of the besieging parliamentary forces around the crucial fortress of Newark was suddenly horrified to see a royalist army on the hill above them. Who's that? Where have they come from? Well, it seemed to be Rupert, but it couldn't be Rupert because he'd been in Shrewsbury a few days before. Before they'd finished wondering if this really could be Rupert, the angry wind that was indeed Rupert had swept on them like a wolf on the fold, and Newark was free and relieved. Such a relief. But that wasn't enough. The situation in the north was parlous. Not only were the Scots slowly forcing Cavendish into a corner, the relief of Hull had released the Fairfaxes to do their worst, and they were very busy reclaiming Yorkshire and Lancashire for Parliament. And then Manchester, he was bringing the Eastern Association army through Lincolnshire up towards York. Three on one, that's really not fair. So it was clearly time for a second angry wind, and off Rupert went with a small 7,000 strong army. But never mind, faint heart never won fair lady and all that. The race is not always to the swift nor the battle to the strong. Let us see what we can do. Up to Lancashire he swept, gathering men as he went, relieved Stockport, hooked up with the Earl of Derby, then chased off another parliamentary army and captured Liverpool, turned, attacked the army besieging the Countess of Derby's Latham House, helter-skelter fed the parliamentarians into Bolton, where they were caught and they were slaughtered. So far and so impressive, though in Bolton it seems that Rupert's command of the Earl of Derby may have committed the worst atrocity of the civil wars in England, with the death of 1,600 people, including civilians. Derby would indeed be executed in 1650 in Bolton in recognition of this piece of horror. Now, it might be noted that Rupert carried with him at all times and in all places, and would keep by him forevermore, a letter from his king. The letter was probably composed by George Digby, and read one way, it ordered Rupert to give battle to the rebel army around York. Or read another way, did it? It was so phrased as to be extraordinarily ambiguous, almost as though the author didn't want to be blamed if anything went wrong. Still, Rupert interpreted it according to his idiom, and he was not a stay-at-home sort of chap. But it was a tall order he faced. Cavendish's 10,000 troops were now trapped in York, and outside was not one, not two, but three armies. Leslie was there, Leslie and the Scots were there. Manchester's Eastern Association was there, one big happy family, 27,000 of the blighters. Rupert had more, but still only 14,000. Though, fair dues, if he could somehow hook up with Cavendish trapped inside York, that would even things up. Now, Attergallop is a crying shame in many ways, because there's just no time to tell you about the following battle of Marston Moor. But if you go to episode 393 and part of 394, you can put that right, and I urge you in the strongest possible terms to do yourself that favour. Because Rupert's approach to York was brilliant, creating a diversion that drew off the besieging army, allowing at least some of Cavendish's men to come out to York to join him. It was really clever. And Marston Moor, though, he was then at last outgeneralled, as well as outnumbered. Though it was a close-run thing. Late in the day of the 2nd of July, Leslie, the overall commander, recognised that the Royalist army was standing down for the night, saw an opportunity and boldly ordered the attack, taking Rupert and his men by surprise. Although George Goring then excelled himself as the Royalist cavalry commander and Cavendish's white coats appeared to be getting the upper hand in the centre of the infantry, so much so that Leslie actually thought they'd lost and fled, Marston Moor in the end was Cromwell's victory as well as Leslie's, smashing Rupert's cavalry, rolling up the infantry. As the royal army fled, only 1,000 white coats still stood their ground and with extraordinary bravery would not surrender and died to a man. Looking at all their corpses with their white coats, someone remarked they'd brought their own shrouds. Marston Moor was an utterly crushing victory. Rupert had to hide in a bean field to escape capture, with which the news sheets did have some fun. It should have been the end of the war. The reason it wasn't owed something to the Earl of Essex, something to Charles, and something to the Earl of Manchester. Let me explain, at some length probably. You might remember that the Earl of Essex had taken his army to Lyme Regis. No one quite knew why, because Lyme Regis, though an estimable town, was not strategically important, tucked away as it was on the south coast. Though, fair dues, for some reason, Prince Maurice, Rupert's brother, was besieging it. It seems to have been maybe that Essex harboured a desire for independence and the glory he felt his status as a peer and Parliament's supreme general entitled him to. Anyway, he compounded the felony by continuing on from Lyme into the southwest once he'd shooed Maurice away. And then he kept going west, kept going, all the way to Devon and Exeter. There, incidentally, he narrowly missed Henrietta Maria. She had left Oxford for safety, delivered a child after a hideous pregnancy, and then fled as Essex approached, hiding in stables and farms, finding a boat and making it over to France, where she would stay for the duration and never see her husband again. Going all the way down to Exeter was bad enough, but Essex still kept going, down into Cornwall, which famously is a cul-de-sac. And Charles had spotted all of this, and he realised that it was an opportunity for him, and he followed him, until at last, at Lostwithiel, on the coast, Essex realised he'd doomed his army for absolutely no discernible reason or benefit. There they were, trapped. Charles was just outside with a dominant army. Essex only had infantry left because his cavalry had legged it for home. All not good. So, one fine morning, the 1st of September 1644, Philip Skippon, Essex's general of foot, went to the cupboard of leadership to find his boss. He opened the cupboard and just like Mother Hubbard, he found it was bare because Essex had done a bunk. I mean, seriously. The brown stuff had hit the whirly thing, all because of Essex, and in the middle of the night, he nipped down to the town, found himself a boat, and rowed out to see Warwick's navy waiting offshore. Seriously, in best panto fashion, boo! And so it was left to Skippon to surrender the entire 10,000-strong army to the king with enormous grace, and Charles actually made him a job offer, as it happens, which Philip refused and walked home with his army. Essex had helpfully snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. But look, I said Manchester was also responsible for Marston not marking the end of the war. That is a little harsh, actually, but one thing does seem to be evident. The experience of the bloodshed at Marston had ripped away from Manchester any remaining martial spirit. So he holed up with his army in Lincoln and would not move. I mean, Lincoln is undeniably lovely. But he had a job to do. He had to get his army to Oxford to face the king resurgent before he marched on London, and the Committee of Both Kingdoms told him so in no uncertain terms, and yet he stayed right where he was. Everyone was livid with him, and when he finally did consent to move, he then refused to advance to Oxford to take on Charles and hung around near London. It was perplexing, I mean almost as though, well I don't know, almost as though he didn't want to fight the king at all. So now it's October 1644, and we enter the second Newbury campaign. I should set this up a bit, though you can hear the full story in episode 395, Forever Newbury. There's a sort of arena in which it takes place. Think very broadly of a triangle with Oxford at the apex, Donnington Castle and nearby Newbury to the west, and Basing House to the south. Broadly, I said. Geographers, don't roll your eyes at me like that. So both of the latter two, Basing House and Donnington Castle, are being besieged by Parliament, who are aiming thereby to draw a noose around the neck that is Oxford. Well, while Manchester is still noodling around near London, and Charles is in the west towards Gloucester, hesitating, a royalist commander called Gage flits into the warm hall of our story and, like Bede's sparrow, flies out again into the cold of historical oblivion. Gage raids. Out from Oxford with a small detachment, he suddenly appears at Basing House. He drives off the besieging Colonel Richard Norton, Idle Dick, Cromwell affectionately calls him. Basing House is relieved and resupplied. Everyone feels more cheerful. Gage rides on, raids a cheese market at Basingstoke and arrives back in Oxford before you can say, Gromit, we forgot the crackers. Everyone cheers, except the grim-faced parliamentary commanders Essex, Manchester and Waller. They ain't smiling. The Gage raid stirs multiple stumps. Charles stops hesitating and advances towards Donnington Castle to drive the besiegers off there. The parliamentary armies and commanders meet near Basingstoke, and together they are formidable. There are 19,000 troops with them, and they now finally look cross and have fiery pants. Charles isn't worried because he knows they don't get on and can't agree on anything, and so he takes up a well-defended position between two rivers under the walls and guns of the liberated Donnington Castle. The inhabitants of Newbury watch all this and roll their eyes in turn. What? Wasn't one major battle enough? Don't worry, said Charles. I'll be long gone by the time they arrive. But he was not right. Obviously, you can't accuse a king of being wrong, but definitely not 100% accurate, shall we say. Because Parliament's generals do agree, and suddenly the rivers have become a trap. Charles finds himself attacked on both sides by an army twice his size. And Skippon and his boys are there, and they are really cross about Lostwithiel. Day one of the battle comes to a close without a final result, largely because once more Manchester takes his time launching his second assault. But everything is looking extremely dodgy for anyone whose name begins with King. So the next day, Manchester and Waller get up looking for a day of happy annihilating, and they look out over the two rivers from their hills, and blow me down, it's empty! Except for maybe a few crisp wrappers. In the middle of the night, quiet as a little mouse, the king and 9,000 of his loving companions have done a bunk, scarpered, legged it. Very embarrassing for Parliament's finest. Very incompetent of them to let him escape. Now the generals think it's all over. They reset the siege of Donnington and head back for London. But Charles isn't done. Now reinforced by Rupert, he returns, drives off the siege of Donnington Castle once more. Newbury is therefore another no-score draw, but coming after Lostwithiel, it's really important because it sets the tone for what follows in Parliament and in the glittering metropolis, that is Uxbridge, where a treaty was supposed to be negotiated. On the one hand, royal confidence has been recovered. Charles has personally played a poor military hand very well indeed. And another incident also buoys him up at this point, and not in a good way. In London, in January 1645, William Lord is executed. Now look, I know Lord's arrogance and unfeeling religious tyranny is a large part of what starts the civil wars, and it means William Lord has blood on his hands. But his trial was despicably biased, and it still failed, and so impeachment was needed. Lord was now an irrelevance. His execution was a disgrace. Charles thought it so appalling that he felt God's vengeance must now surely fall on parliamentary necks. God really, really must be on his side this time, as he'd always been, obviously, but now God's hand would be seen. On the other hand, the mood in London is angry, dazed and confused. All this money, pain, blood and nothing. Incompetence. 3 years and our army and its commanders don't seem to want to fight. When Parliament meets in January, the mood is grim and Parliament is deeply divided. And some of them are talking to the King about peace again. Let me explain. Are you sitting comfortably? Then I shall begin. We are going to talk independents and Presbyterians. Let me start with the independents. In the Westminster Assembly of Divines, a very significant thing had happened. A new Directory of Worship would duly appear, which is a Presbyterian form of worship to be followed by everyone, a new national religion, as it were, which would be followed in Scotland for many centuries, by the way. But a small group within the Assembly had produced a paper with a very different point of view. It said that rather than one national religion, each congregation must find their own way to God. Obviously, they mustn't recognise the Antichrist, also known as the Pope. But with that aside, follow your conscience. Let's stop all this religious coercion and this idea of one uniform national religion. Their enemies call them sectarians and dribble slightly. We are going to call them independents. And it's religion that is the main factor in being an independent. And they're becoming much more powerful, much more common in England, especially London. Now, the independents really worry the English and Scottish Presbyterians, who firmly believe what people have believed in Europe since Christianity tipped up, that pluralism was an offence against God's truth. There must be one national church. How could a matter of God's conscience be otherwise? And ours is, of course, the right interpretation of God's conscience. Such is the Christian view. Or it was, anyway. So this group are now beginning to think maybe an outright victory over the king would not actually be the result they want. There were more and more independents in Parliament. Maybe a victory for Parliament would simply hand power to the independents. So they approach the king to try and make peace. The so-called Treaty of Uxbridge. Now, this is a farce. And it will not only crash, it will also burn. The proposals were largely shaped by the Scots, and there is no way Charles would ever have agreed to them. They are lemon-suckingly uncompromising. Nor did Charles anyway have any intention of engaging in good faith. God was on his side now, remember? But there will be some very dodgy discussions by both the Scottish and English Presbyterians to try and get the king on board, no matter what the cost. Of which more later. For this reason, then, the Presbyterian Party will also become associated as a peace party. This complicates things for us now, because politics and religion gets mixed up. Because some independents will support Presbyterian MPs because they want peace more than anything. Conversely, many independents, and Cromwell is one of those that believe in this trendy new idea of religious toleration, recognise that the king is not a man to do business with. His personal history is littered with duplicity and double dealing, and he must be coerced. The war must be pursued with vigour and won. Then we can sort out the terms of the peace, because the king will have no choice but to take part in good faith. So there were a number of Presbyterians who also agreed with this view. And so despite religion, they support the independents in Parliament, also to be known as the War Party. Complicated, innit? To boil it down and make it simple, just forget all the complexities. Independence and war, Presbyterians and peace. Now, much of the Presbyterian fears in particular become rather focused on the person of Oliver Cromwell. For two reasons. One, because he had acquired a reputation for protecting independence within the Eastern Association Army, to the fury of the Scottish Colonel Crawford and Manchester too. And secondly, the new sheets loved him, so he was in the public eye, a public figure. The Scot Robert Bailey saw the danger of this, that Cromwell was seen as a wise and active head, universally well-beloved, as religious and stout. Being a known independent, the most of the soldiers who loved new ways put themselves under his command. There was another problem with Cromwell, of course. the way he treated people seemed to put far too little weight on their social status. Though you should bear in mind that Cromwell is no social radical, more in the paternalistic Elizabethan tradition. Here is one of those famous quotes of his. "I had rather have the plain russet-coated captain that knows what he fights for and loves what he knows, than that which you call a gentleman and nothing else." So, independents and Presbyterians then. Now, traditionally, we think of Whigs and Tories as the first blush of political politics later in the century. But maybe it is earlier than that. Maybe it's now, in the 1640s, with independents and Presbyterians. Certainly, they are publicly recognised tags used by the news sheets and held recognisably different political positions. Just saying. Anyway, all of this came to head in Parliament in a debate starting in November 1644, and it's fascinating enough for you to listen to in episode 396, The New Model. Everyone expected and feared that the failures of 1644 would be swept under the carpet and we'd have interminable war and bloodshed going on for years. But when Cromwell stood up in the Commons to speak and report, that is not what they got. Instead, they listened to a direct, plain-speaking, furious dissection of everything that was wrong. And although he tried not to make it personal, actually, acknowledging that Manchester's convictions were deeply held and principled, nonetheless, he identified a reluctance to pursue the war with proper vigour. As part of which, he related a conversation from the army command meeting before Newbury. When Cromwell had demanded they attack the king, Manchester's response had been, "If we beat the king 99 times, yet he is king still, and so will his posterity be after him. But if the king beat us once, we shall all be hanged, and our posterity be made slaves." "If this be so," replied Cromwell, "why did we take up arms at first? This is against fighting ever hereafter. If so, let us make peace, be it never so base." Nor was Cromwell alone in this view. It seems pretty clear that Waller, for example, in his speech, supported his junior's point of view that fundamental change was needed and it could no longer be ignored. Well, it led to a right furore, in which the social angle can't be ignored. Manchester was a peer of the realm, and here he was being criticised by a Cambridgeshire farmer. And when Manchester's turn came to speak in the Lords, he didn't hesitate to make it personal. He refuted all claims that he was reluctant to fight, and he did that with reason and with care. But then he lost it a bit and went all ad hominem at Cromwell, whom he said was a social and religious revolutionary who hoped to live never to see a nobleman in England. His animosity against the Scots nation was such, as he told me, that he could as soon draw his sword against the Scots as any in the king's army, and he desired to have none in my army but such as were of the independent judgment. I mean, let's not get into detail, but essentially Parliament is as divided as it had ever been, and not just independent Presbyterian, but Commons and Lords too. No one could find a solution until the name Zouche Tate crosses the national story. Zouche was the leader of the committee tasked with suggesting a way forward. He came into the House of Commons with a bit of paper containing these proposals, which Whitlock said he held like a boil on his thumb. His proposal would eventually lance the spoil. The result of all of this toing and froing was the self-denying ordinance. This radical solution declared that you could now only be a member of Parliament or an army commander. You could no longer be both. It was a solution of simplicity and beauty that cut across all the divisions. And it was radical, radical, radical. Okay, I can see you're not convinced. It is radical for two reasons. Firstly, it means there would be a professional army organised and driven by professionals. This army would be recruited and managed by its own independent army command, though reporting to the Committee of Both Kingdoms as the Parliament's executive arm. England would have a standing army at last, though no one thought it would last quite as long as it did, to be fair. Secondly, it's radical because think about who has led every single military venture since time immemorial, who would no longer be involved in any way, shape or form in soldiering. That's right. The nobility, the peers of the realm. No role. Because you can't check out of the House of Lords. So they are completely sidelined. We instead now have a people's army led by the ordinary Joe. Well, relatively ordinary. Essex, Manchester and the House of Lords fought it tooth and they fought it nail. But in reply, the ordinary Joes, Vane and St John in the Committee of Both Kingdoms and the peer, Say and Seal, it has to be said, treated them to a display of naked power politics. They just went ahead and did it anyway, because the House of Commons controlled the money. They could do that, therefore, and there was not a darned thing the Blue Bloods could do about it. The Commons chose their general of the army. It was to be Thomas Fairfax. The Lords sought then to exclude independence from the officer corps he chose. They tried, and they failed. This meant the end of Essex's career. It took him a while to accept it, but by March 1645 he had accepted it and rather elegantly and gracefully resigned his offices. He would die hunting stags in September 1646 and be given a stonkingly well-attended funeral to see him off. Now then, the new model army was born with its general Fairfax and its officer corps of commoners. There was plenty of cavalry, but almost all of the infantry were raw recruits, untested. So, when all this news got to Oxford, there was merriment and a good time was had by all. Ha ha ha! Everything surely was going their way. They faced a divided enemy, and without peers, what good could it be? They faced a raw and newly structured army without noble generals, so what good could it be? Prince Rupert called it the New Noddle Army. Charles dubbed Fairfax the Brutish General. Plus, the Scots were having their bummed as well, about which I need to tell you. We meet the at-a-gallop speed problem again, so I have little time for James Graham, the great Montrose, and his companion and brother-in-arms, Alistair MacCollar. Best to go to episode 395, Forever Newbury, or indeed become a member and listen to the history of Scotland, especially episode 63. It is a great story. Essentially, Montrose and MacCollar go to the Highlands with 45p and a second-hand felt blue bonnet, and then, with an army never more than 3,000 strong, mangle every single army the Covenanters could send against them. MacCollar is the man who invented the tactic of the Highland charge, by the way, which is not just a lot of men running fast and bravely, by the way. It was an extremely well thought through and highly effective tactic involving multiple steps. See episode 395. Six straight victories they will win against always bigger armies, until they seem to have Scotland in their grip. This meant that the Scots army in England was seriously distracted and they would not come south to fight and had to send a lot of regiments home anyway. That brings us then kicking and screaming to the Naseby campaign, which you can hear about in episode 397, In Assurance of Victory. Rupert and Charles saw they faced a danger and they faced an opportunity, as sure as eggs is eggs. Fairfax would focus on Oxford. He needed to be drawn away, and Rupert had a plan for that. After all, his 10,000 men army was much smaller than Fairfax's 13,500. So, here's the plan. He would do the bird with a broken wing bit. Have Fairfax chase him away from Oxford. Because there was a great opportunity to then turn around and give him a beating. George Goring had a force around Taunton, and 3,000 foot had been recruited in Wales. So if they could join Fairfax as he drew Fairfax on with his broken wing thing, Rupert would then have an army of, say, 16,000 suddenly, could turn, reduce the new noddle to noodle soup, and the king would enjoy his own again. And it works. Or, well, the first bit works. Rupert sacks Leicester as a lure to Fairfax, one of Rupert's several sacks that earn him the thuggish tag, and Fairfax comes after him. Trouble is, there's no sign of the Welsh leathers, and George Goring was as drunk as a lord and too drunk to move a muscle from Taunton, and so we get to the night before when the armies are now just 6 miles away from each other and we have a fateful meeting. Rupert advises the king that since they still only have 10,000 men, discretion is the better part here. They should retreat and wait until those reinforcements can join them. But here the factionalism of the court and the idiotic overconfidence of George Digby takes over. The courtiers around the king advise battle, and Charles himself does not wish the dishonour of running away from rebels. And so they fight, just north of a little village called Naseby. It is a fascinating battle, the Battle of Naseby, on the 14th of June 1645, that effectively decides the First Civil War, and I commend episode 397 to you, where you can hear how Pot, Dan, Charlotte and I walk the fields. It is surprisingly hard fought, given the size difference, but Fairfax's energy and leadership, Skippon's hard-bitten, stubborn resistance, and the discipline of Cromwell's Ironsides win the day. Charles's army is smashed and smashed beyond repair. He runs to Wales to do a spot of hunting, as you do when your world is in ruins. Rupert runs to Bristol and the sympathetic shoulder of the Duchess of Richmond. Fairfax doesn't wait a minute. He picks his army up, tells them to stop resting on those laurels because there's work to do. The Western Campaign in 1645 sees the new model march in pristine order and discipline down the southwest to Langport, where the last major Royalist army under George Goring is given a toasting and George legs it to Spain. On the way, incidentally, and probably the most interesting thing about the Western Campaign, is that Fairfax meets several counties which are being run not by the county committees, but by the locals in the form of clubmen. Because the locals had put up with this violence for long enough, and they'd instead imposed their own order and peace. They refused to allow soldiers to fight there, and they made declarations that they will run things until the King and Parliament sort this mess out, do their duty, and restore order. The clubmen are a fascinating phenomenon, and you can hear more about them in episode 398. The rest of the Civil War is easily dealt with, although you might go to episode 399 to hear about Charles's dilemmas. There are a few Royalist strongholds left, but no major land armies really. Ralph Hopton in Cornwall would be defeated at Torrington in February 1646 by Fairfax. The last pitch battle is figured to be Stow in the Wold, when Jacob Astley's last 3,000 men of reformados were defeated by Thomas Morgan. Fairfax and the regional armies between them had swept up the remaining royal garrisons, the biggies like Exeter and Chester, and the small fry like Basing House. The end of the First Civil War is usually figured to be the 24th of June, when Oxford surrendered, although Harlech is still royalist until March 1647, as it happens. But even the men of Harlech were unlikely to have turned things around by that stage. Charles, however, was not in Oxford when it surrendered. By the time this happened, all Charles's options seemed to have evaporated. The potential for a deal with Confederate Ireland had gone with the farce and revelation of Charles's secret dealings and the arrival of the hardliner Rinuccini, for whom complete conquest of Ireland for the Catholic Church was the way forward, not a deal with the king. In Scotland, Montrose's extraordinary campaign had finally come to naught at the hands of David Leslie and his governantes at Philiphaugh in September 1645. Charles appears to have mentally prepared himself for two things by this stage. One, no compromise to conscience and rebels come what may. And the that may that might come could be martyrdom, and if that's the way it was, well, fine. However, on the 27th of April 1646, Charles could see one more option, and at 1 o'clock in the morning, he left Oxford by the Magdalen Gate, secretly described as Harry, a servant between two royal advisers, heading east, maybe towards London, or maybe not. Now then, that brings us to the end of this episode. It's gone on a bit, but we have covered a lot of ground. Before I leave, let me remind you about the core episodes, though I have been doing that, but also that you can listen to all of my podcasts free of adverts and access over 100 hours of extra shedcasts by becoming a member at thehistoryofengland.co.uk. Also, you would thereby support my work and make me happy, which is surely a good thing, capital G, capital T. That's thehistoryofengland.co.uk. Become a member. Until next time then, gentle listeners, thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks for your comments and reviews and all that sort of thing. Good luck and have a great week.